This week on the podcast, JP is going to continue our conversation with Kate Fagan, author of the book, What Made Maddie Run. Now, last week, we started a conversation about the athletic and collegiate career of Madison Hollerin, the All-American girl, homecoming queen, 4.0 student who went off to college to be a Division I track athlete and tragically took her own life before the start of her second semester of her freshman year in college. This week's conversation is going to center around three themes that kind of emerged from the book. And the first one is thinking about Maddie's story as the victim of an aspiration-driven culture. In other words, so often our athletes are told that they have to achieve more, that they have to play at the highest level, that they have to be the star and achieve that athletic status in our society. But I don't know that we ask the question at what cost until we're confronted with a tragedy like Maddie's story. So we're going to get into a little bit of how that culture affects our athletes in our conversation here today. The second thing we're going to discuss is what do we do when a player comes into our office and they want to quit? Now, in Maddie's story, if you've read the book or you listened to episode one, you'll remember that her depression and her mental health issues gradually built throughout her first semester in college. And she goes home, and maybe for the first time, she tries to articulate sort of this darkness that has overcome her mind and overcome her emotions in a letter to her coach. She schedules a meeting, she goes up and visits with her track coach over break with the intention of quitting, trying to explain this place that she's in and thinking that maybe getting out of sport is the only way out. And yet on the other side of the desk, the coach has no idea really what Maddie is going through and does what many of us would do as coaches, which is try to give her a lifeline without her walking away from the sport. And obviously the question becomes for us as coaches is how do we know when a player is just struggling with their passion for the game, or maybe they're tired, or maybe they're just overwhelmed with their first year academic load, or maybe they are facing some significant mental health issues. Kate's going to talk with JP a little bit about how to engage in that conversation. And then finally, an overarching theme throughout the book is Maddie's relationship with her social media self. And we hear as coaches all the time about how this world that kids are growing up in is vastly different than the one that I grew up in as a 42-year-old male 25 years ago. There wasn't the pressure of always being able to see what other athletes were doing, what other teams were doing, what my friends were doing on Friday and Saturday night, and having to compare my own experience to that constantly, day in and day out. Not only that, Kate will talk about the pressure that Maddie faced to portray herself to her social media audience in a very specific way and the pressure that she experienced because of that. Now, coaches, at the end of this conversation, you may be left with the impression that our players and our athletes are growing up in some foreign land, almost as though they're members of some alien culture. And that is by design. What we hope that you get out of these first 2 weeks of our series on just our athletes' mental health is just an understanding of the world that they are living in so that we can interact with them more effectively in it.
You're listening to the Coaching Culture Podcast. I'm JP Nurbin alongside my co-host Nate Sanderson. Every week in around 30 minutes, we're giving you strategies and tools for you to grow as a leader and build your culture. We know the reason why most teams struggle, and that is because they have a dysfunctional culture. This leaves coaches frustrated with entitled players, losing seasons, and toxic environments. And at Thrive on Challenge, we believe that the silver bullet is a transformational culture. We help coaches to create and sustain transformational cultures so they can strengthen relationships, raise standards, and inspire others to make an impact. To learn more about our workshops, retreats, and mentorship program, go to thriveonchallenge.com. You can also get the coaching notes PDFs for every Coaching Culture episode by subscribing to our weekly newsletter. You're listening to episode 139, Prioritizing the Mental Health of Our Athletes with Kate Fagan, Part 2. So Kate, not only did I resonate with the book as a father and a coach, but I really resonated with you and Madison's story on a personal level. Throughout the book, you discuss dreams, and I haven't heard other people articulate this struggle or this challenge that dreams often present for athletes like you have before. So it was really, really powerful for me because I think so often as a society, we tell kids, chase your dreams, you know, and we build up this vision that, you know, achieving your dreams is the end all be all. And there's two big points that I felt you made that I kind of want you to elaborate on. And the first is that, in your opinion, Madison might have felt that the Ivy League dream was possibly just, as you said, a dream she felt she was supposed to have. And I really connected with that because I think in today's sports culture, if an athlete doesn't want to play at the next level, at a high level, then often they're labeled as lazy or lacking ambition. The second big point you make there around dreams is you talked about being trapped by your dream. Like when you got to college, you were afraid of quitting basketball because you didn't want to be labeled as, you know, that person that gave up on their dreams. Well, along my journey to become a basketball player, I definitely had times where I think I held on to my dream because I didn't want to be labeled as a quitter. Maybe not because I actually just really had that dream anymore. And honestly, when I achieved that dream and I walked onto a Division I basketball team, it was a huge letdown. Like it was not the dream come true that I thought it would be. And that led to me feeling though, that I actually had to put on this face that life is great because here I've achieved my dream. You know, when people would ask me how I was doing, you know, I would talk about that. Oh, this is great. You know, dream come true. But in reality, life was far from great. It was a really big challenge. So I was hoping you would speak a little to maybe some of the challenges that players or athletes having a dream presents for them and for the people that are there trying to support them.
The part that I want to get across, and I think this relates to what you're saying, is that I think especially within sport, and I'll explain why, we don't allow enough credence to the fact that our kids might not all be desperately in love with the sport that they're playing. And so I know your question is larger, kind of about some of the trappings of this idea of dreams. But if we look specifically at sports, and I think this is an important point, and I'm not sure if I made it in the book or if I've started to think about it in a couple years and talking to so many student athletes afterward. But so if we look at sports in the terms of like our kids dreaming about greatness in sports, I think there's a lot of kids whose, obviously that dream is not necessarily theirs. And that's, you know, the old like parent thing too. But if you take it even farther, I'd be hard pressed to find something in our society that a young child can do that gets as much benefit from as sports. And so I see that impacting, I see that thread play out all the way to the college level. So, I mean, we could argue this point, whether sports is most valued in our society or like maybe musical talent or, you know, I don't know, mathematical ambition, but maybe it's just the world I live in, but it feels that when a young kid tries a sport and is good at it, the feedback that they get in that sport, it makes it pretty hard for that kid to like not keep doing that sport. And, you know, whether it's like parents basking in the glory and so much positive reinforcement from coaches, from peers, from teachers, you get to this place with sports, I think, and I see this in a lot of kids by the time they reach the college level, where whether or not they love that thing has been overshadowed all along the way by how awesome it makes them feel and how much awesome feedback they get from doing that thing. And I talk to so many student athletes who get to the college level, and this is the first time where the cost of playing the sport has gone really, really high. And the cost, I mean, you know, two-a-days, early mornings, at this new high level in this place without your parents in a new place. And oftentimes the benefit, you know, because kids at that freshman level, usually, sometimes they're stars, but usually like they're not playing quite as much and they're being tested and they're being broken down. So the benefits of playing that sport have really plummeted, which is surprising to kids when they step on the college level because they think, oh, now I've made it, right? It's going to be, you know, big man on campus and I'm wearing the gear and I'm a star. But often you see that imbalance, the cost going up and the benefits going down, and then they're asking themselves like a really tough question about whether they ever loved this thing to begin with. And then wrapped up in all of that is like, whoa, how could you ever not love a sport? Because sports are fun, they're games, like we play them. It's like, you know, we even say, like, baseball players, like, they're playing a kid's game for money. Like, there's not a lot of space in our society to say that you are struggling with playing a sport because sports are supposed to be fun. So, you know, I think that that is a little separate from, you know, the overall question about this, our achievement culture, and how it's like, if you don't have some big, huge goal, if you don't have some big, huge dream, then what are you even doing with your life? That I think has run out of control. And that's not to say, I think, I'm not advocating just like mediocrity. But at the same time, it's like, you know, do we really think every single one of our kids needs to be, you know, the 0.01%? Because not all our kids can be. And what else are we valuing within that? You know, kindness and all these different traits that seem to have fallen by the wayside in a lot of places. So I'm not sure I totally answered your question there, but I wanted to get that point in about sports. And I think how a lot of our kids can start feeling when they get later on in their career and start to develop a little bit more of a mind of their own and deepen their soul about how they feel about what they're doing.
No, I think you hit it right on the head there of so much, I think, as adults or just society's projecting onto kids that they have to have a certain dream just because they're good at it. I think that becomes, if they don't want to play at the next level, then they're not passionate, they're not committed, you know. And I've seen so many coaches have that perception around their own athletes because they don't want to do this 12 months a year all throughout the summer. They want to have a summer job, and it's like, oh, they want to go to Paris, or they want to go to the beach, or they want to have, like, people, like, what's so wrong about that? We make kids feel kind of crummy about it. Now, I was in love with the game of basketball. For many reasons, I feel like I fell out of love with that game of basketball. But I still think when I got to college, I had this realization of, like, what was I actually pursuing? Was I pursuing the game, like, to be able to continue to play the game and compete? Or was I pursuing this fancy, shiny thing of playing Division I, you know, having the opportunity? You know, I got to play in Madison Square Garden on two occasions. And you get there and you're like, man, this isn't about the game, because if I really loved the game, I would probably have gone Division III, where I kind of would have played a lot, you know? And I think there's a lot of the message is we build up this idea around the dream. And like you said, with the book, with Madison, and she got there, and maybe there was that real letdown, and you obviously experienced it yourself.
Yeah, and if you, the way you can look at Maddie, and that I did too, was that, think about the way she started to funnel herself away in pursuit of the dream, right? So, and I think this is a bit of a mirroring that I think so many kids do. It was, she loved soccer most. And so initially, of course, she's going to play soccer at the highest level she can, without question of whether, should I play D1 or should I play D2 or should I play D3, that I don't think many kids ask themselves. It's like, if you're capable of playing D1, you play D1. Of course you do. And so it was, I'm going to play D1 at Lehigh. I'm going to play soccer. And then she was willing to funnel away playing soccer, which she loved more, and run track because it was going to get her one notch higher on, like, the societal scale of the quality of your dream, right? An Ivy League school. How much more impressive is that? And I do believe that maybe she couldn't have articulated this, but when I talked to everyone around her, they're like, spot on. This is kind of the funneling process that happened. So, all right, I'm not going to play the sport I love. I'm going to play this sport that I'm new to and it doesn't totally fit my personality type, to get one notch higher on that dream, to have that stamp of approval for society. And I think that's how at least so many of our kids have operated. You just articulated it perfectly about playing, you know, at South Carolina. And it's how I felt at Colorado. I can remember going in the off season, when we used to have off seasons in the NCAA, you know, now kids just have almost no time to themselves. I would play pickup at the rec and I'd be like, and I would love it. And I was like, I do love basketball. And I'm like, why? But then the second I had to, like, do all of the really almost suffocating, like, you know, hill workouts all summer long, it just stripped away. And I'm not saying that it's such a tough balance, because it's like, of course you have to do those tough workouts, but it's more than that. It's more like the NCAA and the Division I and that pursuit, it can feel suffocating. And I remember feeling when I played rec ball, I was like, man, what if I just come to college to study and played rec ball every day? Like, how awesome would that be? You know, and who knows, right? It's like this false negative you can't prove. Like, I didn't live that life. I'd probably have the same problems and the same feelings, but I know exactly what you mean about, like, that pure kind of, like, love and playing, and how that can be very quickly stripped away when you start to put money and achievement into the mix.
Yeah, absolutely. I love that. And I think this kind of brings me to the next thing I wanted to kind of dive in with you about, is just this advice that we can give to players when they want to quit, right? There's a moment where Madison wanted to quit. And I think most of us coaches have had players that have wanted to step away from the game. Parents, at some stage, our kids are going to be like, I'm done with this. They want to throw their shoes down on the ground. They're saying, I'm not going back to practice. And what is the normal response? The response is, no, you've got to push through it. I don't want you to live with regrets in life. You know, I don't want you to give up on this dream. And so we try to encourage and push. And, you know, and you see in the case with Madison, they were trying to support her and work with her in such a way that she could kind of do the sport as you know, a little bit at a time and kind of step away at the same time. It's just such a really hard thing to navigate. I mean, from your own experience and, you know, just not just even Madison's story, but talking, because I know you've talked to so many athletes and people out there. What advice would you give to coaches and even parents when one of their players expresses or their kids express a desire to quit?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think this is the trickiest one of the trickiest questions in the book. So the advice I have to coaches, and just to give listeners a little bit of a background, Maddie, who haven't read the book, Maddie, it was about a week before she took her own life. She went into the track and field coach's office. She had actually written a couple page document, or which was, I think, the most honest she was about how she was truly feeling. And she said within it, like, I'm in a darker place than I ever thought possible. She read this note out loud in hopes of, you know, leaving track and field at Penn and having that second semester to kind of explore who she was outside of sports. And her mom was in that meeting, and the end result of the meeting, and this is that her family does not have any, you know, her mom supported this decision and didn't want her daughter to leave the sport either. The end result was that she would kind of cross train for a couple of weeks. You know, she'd do the elliptical on her own, and but she was still, you know, she was still on the emails of, like, in a month, Maddie's going to be running the 800 at this meet, right? Or, you know, so she wasn't separated from the sport. She was kind of, like, still tied to it. So that tricky question of, like, what should a coach do? Because I agree with you and with most coaches I talk to that the majority of kids who come in and they want to leave a sport, it probably is going to benefit them to stick it out. I mean, it definitely benefited me to stick it out. And again, I wasn't dealing with the kind of mental health issues Maddie was in that moment. But so that knee-jerk reaction to make sure that the kid doesn't is, I think, the place I want to start when I talk to coaches about just a simple shift in their mind. And that is that almost every coach I know enters one of those meetings and their goal is to get the kids to stay. And I think simply shifting the mindset to being like, perhaps I'm going to enter this meeting, I'm going to listen very carefully, and perhaps it's not right for this kid to stay right now. And perhaps instead of thinking of it as black and white, I'm going to get the kid to stay, right? Because even saying, you might say, and this is what a lot of coaches do, like, let's take 2 weeks, you work out on your own, we'll check in every day, and then we'll assess where we are. For a lot of kids, that feels like you're still tethered to the sport, and it's not the true kind of, like, I want to explore who I am on my own. So I think for a coach to simply go into that meeting and say to themselves, I'm open to the idea that this kid should not continue this sport right now. So just gets back to my black and white point, right? Either the kid is gone forever, the kid left the sport and I never see them again, or we keep tethered to me somehow in a looser way, and then we reignite the more, like, involved nature of the sport. But, like, what about the gray area where, like, Maddie could have taken the spring semester off and then they would reevaluate over the summer. Or, you know what, maybe a kid does need a year break from the sport. And that doesn't mean that the kid can't get back into the sport, but maybe they do need that space, whether it's for a mental health reason or because they want to see who they are outside of the sport. Maybe they'll come back even better. I think it's that gray area that I don't see a lot of coaches living in and thinking of it as an option. I think that's one thing. And that's the main thing I would say. The parents, too. Like, there was a difference in my mind if you listen very carefully to what Maddie said in that meeting and the letter she wrote. That was very different to me than I'm sick of this and I want to go party more. You know, now I'm being very like, you know, swinging the pendulum all the way to the other side, but really listening to find out whether this is like a mental health issue, a passion issue, and really living in like that we can take breaks from things and come back to them. So anyway, that's kind of like the main advice I have when I talk to coaches about this specific issue.
No, I love that because I think so often like my default response would be to try to instantly inspire them with my own story of when I wanted to quit as a junior. In high school, I pushed mm-hmm. through and look at me, I went off to achieve my dreams, right? And that's not necessarily what they need to hear. In fact, I think what you're pointing out there is they need us to listen, right? And they just really kind of walk with them and be open. I think that's a powerful thing, is just be open to the fact that them continuing in the sport may not be the best thing for them. But I also think this comes back a little bit to what you were talking about earlier, which is, are we allowing breaks? You know, like this performance culture of this, do all these extra workouts, lack of sleep. I even see it now a little bit, and I don't, you know, I think that there's a real value with what's going on with the coronavirus. I see a lot of coaches are working so hard to stay connected with their athletes during this time, and I think there's a benefit to that because I think it's obviously meant there's going to be a toughness to them being isolated from their team and their friends. But I also think, man, what about the fact that they're not having to do their sport for a few months? Could that actually be really good for some kids? And I don't know. I think it could be really encouraging to see if coaches read your book and they hear that message, to see them say, you know what, maybe we don't need to be training 12 months of the year.
Yeah. Just to add on to that, when I was at ESPN, if I was hosting a show, we'd have like an NBA player on or a WNBA player on, or even a different professional athlete, we'd get talking and inevitably we'd talk about their college experience. And to a person, every single one of those pro athletes said that they had never trained harder than they did in college. And that when they got to the pros, that there was so much adherence to the science that while certainly, you know, it's not like it's easy to be a professional athlete, but there was rest built in. There was rest and recovery days built in, you know, where they were doing yoga on days instead of running sprint workouts. And they're like, there's something going on at like the elite high school level and the college level. And it's about the coaches more than it is about the players. It's almost like a coach's obsession with not missing a day of workout and thinking that overtraining will get you to the place you want to be. And I see that still. I see that to this day. Like, kids need more than half of a day off every week. You know, the kids need like 2 to 3 days off a week. You know, whether they're doing a, you know, like a yoga or something more like stretchy on one day. And it's almost like the personality types of the coaches are driving that behavior. And you can, you know, that you can see that happening, whether it's like the needing to work out every single day of the week. And you see that playing out too, to what you've mentioned numerous times about like, you need to be playing your sport at all times, because if you're not, someone else is. And like, it's like, I don't know how many more ways we can say like success, getting to where you want to go is not just 100% hard work. It's like 50% hard work, 25% rest, you know, 20% good eating, 10, you know, more, probably more good eating, but like good thinking. Like it's like this well-rounded pursuit. And it's not about checking the box every day that you did the 1000 meter sprints or the 2000 meter sprints. And I think we've got coaches who also need to calm down a little bit on their obsession with what they need to be getting from their athletes, because then parents buy into it. You guys are in the middle of it, so you probably know all of that cycle even better than I do.
Well, we just about 10 episodes ago, we did a episode largely on sleep and just how NBA athletes were being really intentional in their sleep. And we're like, man, this is something that's completely ignored at the high school and collegiate level in so many aspects. But I think what you're touching on there too, though, is this culture around that is made even worse by the fact of that we live in this digital world and social media, right? So we see if one player is working out, they got to post it on there. Well, I'm not working out. If a coach is doing this with his team, well, oh man, I'm not doing that with my team. And you talk a lot about the negative effects around social media, not just even social media, but just the digital world, like digital communication and text messaging. That's obviously one of them, but there's some other things in there. Why do parents and coaches need to be concerned about social media and digital communication when it comes to the mental health of our athletes?
So, yeah, I think that we've talked a lot in the last 5 years, generally speaking, about, you know, social media, you know, just that the life someone's projecting on social media is not very rarely an accurate reflection of their life. I think there's some like common sense ideas around social media right now, but I think what's the best way to illustrate, I think, how I've started to feel about social media was this idea I wrote about in the book that I'll extrapolate on, was just this idea of like divisions of self. And so, you know, quickly, what I mean by that is that basically throughout human history, we've had to deal with like two versions of who we are inside our own minds and private, and then who we are around friends and family, other people. And like, those aren't usually, I mean, for most of us, like, it's not the same exact person. And there are things I will say to myself and I will do that, like, because I've been socialized, I know I cannot do around other people. And throughout human history, the only population that has had to deal with like a third division of who they are is celebrities. And then they've had to be who they are inside their own minds, who they are around other people. And then that third level of like who they are as a public performance and as, like who they are for mass consumption. And I think what social media has done to us, and I think to all kids, is that whether they have like, you know, 72 followers on Instagram or Snapchat or TikTok, or you have 70 million, it doesn't take away the simple fact that that is an act of a public performance and an act of mass consumption of who you are. And I think that's what we really, really have to keep in mind when it comes to how we see social media impacting our kids, is like, okay, if they're, you know, they're engaging in a kind of like public performance, who they are for mass consumption. Like, there's a lot of ways that they're being able to see, like you said, like they can see what someone's life is like that they never could see before. Like, we used to live in our towns and it was like, you saw what was around you and that was kind of the dream you had. Now we all have to compare ourselves to like, who, I don't know, Ariana Grande. Like, we all have to Taylor Swift. I know, like, we all have to see that life, and now we can compare our life to that life. But back to this point of mass consumption, public performance, like, I think the thing that really opened my eyes when it came to writing Maddie's story and having her computer was that I got to see how much she edited a photo and how many times she took a photo. And so the photo that she posted a couple hours before she died in downtown Philly, I can tell you that she took that photo 7 times and she edited it countless more times. And so to me, that's what I mean when I say, like, okay, our kids are engaging in a public performance. Maddie is in a place where she's clearly, I can't even articulate how she's feeling right then, right? But she's struggling so deeply. And what trumps that struggle is this idea that she has to put up the perfect picture so that people will think of her in a certain way. Yeah, so I think we're just starting to do the research that needs to be done to really assess how this public performance that we're all engaged in, especially our kids, is impacting how they see themselves and the goals they set for themselves and how those are in balance or completely out of balance with their own internal compass and their sense of self-worth and all of these really crucial factors that we don't know yet how it's being impacted. But I think as parents and coaches and just, you know, citizens of the world, it's a really important factor to understand that like how we grew up is not how they're growing up. And if you see it impacting you in a small way as an adult, imagine someone whose sense of self is in the process of being built. And so I think that's really important for parents and coaches to kind of to remember to not apply their own experience as a solution, but to realize that, like, it's completely different water in which they're swimming. And so your experience may be somewhat relevant, but might not be fully relevant to how they're feeling inside.
Yeah, and I think that it's just even your tale of Madison there, of us making judgments about people based upon what they post on social media, is not a really good, ever a good gauge of how they're actually doing, you know. And I think that comes back to your encouragement to have that personal relationship. I mean, you had that very powerful line in the book where you said, "I've spent more time on Instagram exercising my image than I have in the gym exercising my body. These two presentations are not the same person. In fact, they are often two very different people." And as coaches, you know, we've got to work really hard to be intentional to connect with that real person that may be struggling inside, or they may be doing fine, but we have to work hard to connect with that. I think we're not going to get rid of social media anytime soon. So I don't know if you have any suggestions as far as how to, as coaches or parents, to navigate that based upon your experience of Madison's story and the work that you've done going around speaking about this.
No insight. I don't have any insight that's any, you know, more complicated than what we've talked about, you know, throughout this conversation, which is just like communication and being willing to ask kids different questions, not the same old questions, and really keeping those lines open and not making assumptions based on what we see or based on what they might tell us in those superficial interactions of like, "Hey, how you doing today?" And like, that's really the core of it. You know, when I think about Maddie and I think about coaching, I think one of the things that really struck me, and we talked about it earlier, that I had a trainer that I was connected to. Maddie didn't have that person when she was at Penn, you know, and you guys are coaches, you know, like when you have that person, whether I think back when I was growing up and you have that person you're showing up for that you just love being around, or, you know, you just vibe with them, it just makes the sport so much more enjoyable and it helps so deeply our mental health. So I think as a really simple kind of test coaches can do, or even parents, like if so-and-so was struggling, who would they talk to on this team? And if your answer is nobody, I have no clue, then it's possible, right? The kid might be doing great, but it's possible they might be adrift or struggling in some way, because we all really do need those people that we show up for, not just in sports, but in life. You know, when you got a job and you have a colleague you vibe with, you do better work. And so I think, you know, that, I mean, that's like a simple little question that I think that parents and coaches could be asking themselves, like, are you connected with this person? Do you feel that they would come to you with something? And if the answer is no, then, you know, trying to build someone on a team and make those connections possible is really imperative to having like that really healthy, wonderful experience that I know all coaches, well, not all coaches, but most dedicated coaches want to create for their athletes.
Absolutely. Well, I appreciate that. And I appreciate all you've offered here today on the podcast. Every time I go and deliver a workshop for parents, which I do often when I speak at high schools and I'm working with teams there, I do a parent workshop, I always finish, one of the last slides is a picture of your book, and I tell them they need to go buy this. I'm constantly pushing it out there because I think your message is so important. And like you've kind of said, you don't necessarily have all the solutions, but just us becoming more aware of this as parents and as coaches is really, really, really important. I don't know if you have a kind of a parting message or for us, is because so many of our listeners are high school and college coaches. And, you know, we've had a lot, you've given us so much today, but just want to give you an opportunity if you wanted to, just to maybe leave us with one, something that maybe we didn't touch on today that you think is really, really important for coaches to be thinking about.
Yeah. Well, you know, thanks again for having me. I'm so glad the book has mattered, and hopefully, you know, more coaches will be able to find it and be able to impact some of their kids and their student athletes. I guess the one thing that we haven't touched on that I think is important for coaches is we can talk for an hours about like, how do we help kids and how do we help their mental health? But I think one place to start is to make sure that the coaches themselves are realizing that they've got their own mental health to deal with, and what ways did their, if we're looking specifically at athletics, like what ways did their athletic experience influence the way they're coaching, or even more deeply, what ways did it traumatize them? Because I think a lot of athletes do have a lot of trauma, and I don't mean that in a dramatic way. I mean, you know, there's a lot of coaches I see out there who, you know, were traumatized by coaches, like old school coaches, but they survived it, and therefore they're perpetuating this belief that we need to absolutely break everybody down to their very core before we can build them back up. And if I survived it, then these kids can survive it. And I think that coaches should also just ask themselves, like, what was my, where's my mental health at? Am I bringing that to my kids? Am I putting expectations on them? And am I coaching in a way that is almost perpetuating this cycle of like belief of what it is to play sport? You know, that it is this fully breaking down nature and like survival of the fittest. And it is in many ways, but I think that it can be different than it was, you know, previous generation. So I think asking that question is also a really great starting point for coaches.
So I'm not sure if there could have been a more important reminder for us as coaches as we wrapped up our conversation with Kate Fagan. It's so important that we are taking care and addressing our own mental health challenges and struggles. How can we ask our athletes, right? How can we ask our athletes to get help if we aren't getting help ourselves? So one of the questions that you may be having is, all right, where do we go from here? And here's just a few recommendations I want to give every listener on the podcast. First off, if you haven't already, buy What Made Maddie Run by Kate Fagan and read it. Secondly, support the Madison Hollerin Foundation. Go to madisonhollerinfoundation.org. I'll put a link in the episode details. Third suggestion here is to read an amazing article by college basketball coach and a Thrive On Challenge mentor, Coach Shane Souden, who recently wrote about his own mental health struggles and how it's equipped him to walk alongside his athletes. Fourthly, if you have players wanting to quit, go back to episode 106 of the Coaching Culture Podcast. Nate and I discuss some strategies on how we can walk with athletes as they wrestle with that question on whether to quit or not. And lastly, subscribe to the podcast. We're not done talking about mental health. Our next few episodes of the podcast are going to dive into the ways that we can address mental health with our team. Since last week's episode, I've had many coaches reaching out and starting to share their story with me on their own personal challenges, but also how they have lost athletes, lost young men and women to suicide. And we don't think that there is anything more important than the mental health of every member of our program. And we are going to continue to try to provide as much value and support for our listeners of the podcast as we can on this growing concern in today's sporting culture.